Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 132 for comics originally released on February 17th, 2010. As always, we're going to talk about a DC comic book, a Marvel comic book, and a comic book from some other publisher. Because, I mean, there's tons of great stuff coming from all these publishers, and, you know, hey, we want to talk about all of it. So, what we're going to start with this time on DC is Supergirl 50.
Boy, I had a lot of catching up to do to get to Supergirl number 50. I had let my DC fall behind, and actually my Superman family, I had not read and since S-Shield issue number 17. And Supergirl 50 was S-Shield issue number 28. So people who don't read the Superman family at DC each month, they put like a little number, kind of indicates which one. So I had 12 comics to catch up on in the Superman family before I read Supergirl.
That's funny. I'm doing pretty good about staying current these days, so I did not have that problem. And then I suspect it'll result in a slightly different reading experience just based on how much is kind of fresh in your memory and how much isn't. Of course, with my memory, it doesn't matter how recently I've read some stuff, it doesn't seem to stick that much. Overall, I kind of like this issue. I felt the $4.99 cover price was a little harsh. Yes, it was extra length. We got a 40-page story and a 6-page backup. The price per page wasn't bad. It just felt a little expensive because while it was a solid and enjoyable read, it kind of lacked that epic scope that I kind of feel I should get out of a $4.99, 50th, you know, issue thing, if you know what I mean. And that's an expectation thing.
Well, it's interesting you say that because while I like the story, what I did feel is even though it was a 40-page main story, it felt, and it was pretty much almost a done-in-one story as well, it just seemed like it was rushed. You know, they spent like all this time setting up the stuff with Lana. Then they had the big reveal last issue. And then all of a sudden, boom, you've got the development. There's going to be some spoilers here. Okay.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, boom. Okay. So she's Insect Queen. You know, zip, zip, zip. They go through the story and there's a complete resolution for it. And it just seemed like, you know, for something that was setting up, like you said, it didn't really feel like it had that epic scope of it. And I think maybe it's the storytelling style, because first off, they don't start off with that. They start off with the Superwoman subplot. Then they do a time jump and they have Gangbuster and he's running through this tunnel and stuff and he finds Supergirl captured, but we never saw Supergirl getting captured in a previous issue.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, these things where they try to get all cutesy and jumping around with time and stuff, a lot of times, unless they're done really well, they tend to not work for me, and I don't think this one was done that well. And then the resolution, you know, the kind of emotional stuff between Lana and Supergirl at the end, that really didn't ring true for me for the character either.
I had that exact same problem. It felt off. And it felt actually like a bit of backpedaling on Supergirl's character. I mean, if this was the Supergirl that we had at the beginning of this series, I'd have bought that. But given what's happened and how she's grown and matured since then, it felt really, like you said, kind of out of character. I mean, it was one of those things where in this issue, a fair amount did happen for Supergirl, for Lana, for Superwoman. And it's not like this was light on story, but you're right. The storytelling style made it feel a little, I don't say forced, but rushed. And again, skipping over Supergirl having gotten captured, oh, we'll see that in flashback, maybe, all that kind of crap. It's like, it was an end cap for the story that had been going on before. It did sort of have that done in one field, because again, of how much they jump forward and stuff. I think if you took out the Superwoman subplot, this would go much closer to the standard 22-page sort of a story. And overall, I liked the Superwoman stuff. I did not like the second to the last page of the main story here, where I felt it got kind of, frankly, fairly gory there. And when did comics get kind of so carefree and callous about that kind of gore in what, at least I guess, used to be considered and what I would still consider profanity? This is a book that is not a kid's book, but I think is, by and large, an all-ages book.
It's a good book for a teenager, I think, or even a 12, probably 12 and up, 13 and up easily. It's not something that you give a six or seven-year-old.
No, certainly not, but you know what I mean. It's not something that is inappropriate for a younger reader for the most part, yet then they've got people getting, you know, melted and stuff like that and crap, and I'm like, what are they thinking here?
Well, Lucy changed too, because even at the beginning where she blasts her heat vision, you know, a huge hole through that one guy, you know, it's like, was in the previous Superwoman arc, I don't remember her just like callously murdering all kinds of people.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a facet of her being reborn.
Well, but that seemed to be an accident, but the one at the end was definitely not.
Well, it seemed to be an accident until the thing at the end, and then I started wondering, was the thing at the beginning an accident, after all?
At that point, I don't know that she knew she had the heat vision. It's one of those things, though, that those kinds of things, I felt the graphic depiction of that was very kind of over the top and arguably out of line for what I think is appropriate for this book. And frankly, I love Jamal Igel's artwork. It's always a pleasure to read his stuff. He did a great job in this. I don't know if he drew those couple of pages or not. But, you know, that kind of gore, the use of some profanity in here in a few places, you know, certainly there's a sliding scale on what's considered appropriate in society and stuff, and one that, I'm going to say, slowly erodes or whatever. Things that would have been completely outrageous 20 years ago are now, you know, nobody apparently blinks an eye at.
Well, I'm not opposed to, you know, that kind of thing in a comic book, even in a superhero comic book. The thing that makes it a little out of place here is I had thought that DC was pretty much setting up Supergirl as that all-ages, kind of kid-friendly kind of book. And in that kind of a target audience, it is really out of place. You know, so, you know, maybe in a book that, you know, like Green Lantern, you know, I think that's sort of all ages, but I don't think they're, and I won't say Supergirl's being targeted at kids, but it certainly seems like it's more kid-friendly than a lot of titles, especially with, you know, the character being who she is, and especially, we've mentioned this before, since they kind of switched her out from being sort of the, you know, kind of club-hopping little
party girl or whatever, yeah.
Party girl kind of thing, and made her into a much stronger character that could be a role model. I think that it is skewing a little bit more towards a book that is completely appropriate to give a girl who's not that old. As you know, it would be a great book for a 12, 13-year-old girl to be reading with a strong female lead that they can identify with, I think, and all that kind of, all the story elements and things that go along with that. So, you know, in that respect, I think that's what kind of brings some of this stuff out of place.
Hey, for me, I kind of go with the Underoos rule. If this is a character that's been on or currently on Underoos or whatever, if they want to have profanity, if they want to have gore in like a Vertigo title, that's fine. Or a miniseries for even a Batman or something that's marked as a more mature kind of a thing, okay, that's fair game. I'm not saying they can't tell those kinds of stories with certain characters. But in the main titles, I really question the wisdom of doing that. Because while there are a lot of people who, again, won't blink an eye, won't be the least bit offended, there's enough that might be that, you know, with sales where they're at, do you really want to kind of cause those sort of potential problems?
Well, I mean, you could have told this exact same story with those exact same things happening with some art direction a little different that was not as graphic as it was. And again, you know, I don't mind that stuff in general. You know, I read that kind of stuff all the time, but it just seemed out of place in this particular
book. And with the profanity, to me, that's a writing crutch, and these are solid writers. They could have come up with better dialogue.
Well, I find it funny that they did that, because on that full-page spread of Supergirl, and she's, you know, like, what the...
Yes.
You know, and then they have a four-letter Kryptonian word. Well, I translated the four-letter Kryptonian word, and it's Zith, Z-I-T-H.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, they didn't use profanity there. It's not like they took an actual curse word and wrote it in Kryptonian, which, you know, a lot of times in the other Superman titles, you know, when Nightwing and Flamebird or, you know, people are speaking in Kryptonian, they have the... You know, it's a literal translation of them just saying, you know, normal stuff. So I'm thinking, okay, well, that's good. You know, they're not having her use, like, an actual curse word. She's using some, you know, Kryptonian curse, apparently, you know, kind of like when Superman used to run around saying, great row, and stuff like that, you know. It's like, okay. You know, but then when they actually put in the other stuff, it's like, oh, okay, that's interesting choice.
Well, to me, what it... established is, one, Supergirl curses. Two, she can do it in two languages. Three, Kryptonians have curse words. Now, is this a big deal? No, it's not. But it also, it doesn't need to be there. And yes, I'm old school on this. I don't use profanity. I frequently edit it out the few times it slips into the podcast, that sort of a thing. I'm trying to keep things all ages. I think for the mainstream superhero books at DC... I'm puzzled why they don't do the same sort of a thing there. Is it a big deal? No, but I think it doesn't need to be there.
I'm the opposite. I liberally use profanity, and I'm the one you're probably every now and again editing my slips out, because I do try to keep it out of this podcast in deference to making it an all-ages podcast, but I use it quite frequently under normal circumstances. But, you know, we try to keep it out of this show, and, you know, again, it's not like I'm offended by it because I use it myself all the time, but, you know, in contextually.
And that's the thing. I wasn't offended by it in the comic, but I know these are better writers and they could have come up with more clever dialogue or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was an easy way to go for some of the dialogue, and it's like, really? That's the best you got? The backup feature in this was nice, but I would consider unessential reading. It was a fluff piece.
Yeah, I just thought, as strong as Supergirl's been lately,
mm-hmm.
this was not the most shining example on the title.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
It was a weaker than usual issue.
I still thought it was a good issue. It's certainly not one I would put out in front of somebody and say, this is the issue you should start reading with. But I would also say anyone who gave up on the title after its first half year or so, when she was that party girl and all that stuff, they have completely turned this title around and this character around and made her a more interesting character. I mean, they've done a lot with her. And I felt overall, with a few exceptions, this issue furthered in that direction and stuff. I liked the issue. I gave it a 4 out of 5 because I thought it was solid. It got a number of plot points in there. It gave a good resolution to the kind of the storyline. Yes, it was rushed, but we got some good moments for Lana. We got some good moments for Supergirl. They did, I thought, a very good job essentially resurrecting and bringing back Superwoman in a believable manner, setting up some plot points there and stuff. And while I would have liked to have seen more and better in this issue, and it was far from a 5, it was better than the average comic or whatever, so I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, the story to me was weak. The art was way above average, and it pulled it up to a 4 for me. I mean, if the art was not as strong as it was in this issue, I would have given the issue a 3. But because the art was just, you know, really nice, it pulled it up to a 4 for me.
Cool.
It's the visual medium of comics. I'll move on to Doom War number 1.
Yeah. What'd you think of this one?
This was another interesting one. So this one, I had to catch up on some Black Panther that was prelude to Doom War. I had not been buying the Black Panther series. I stopped after the first couple of issues, but when I saw Doom War coming and I saw a lot of these issues being marked as the prelude to Doom War, I started picking those issues up, but I hadn't read them. So I read the like three or four issues prior to this, I think like issues 9 through 12 of Black Panther, mm-hmm. that were that the prelude to Doom War. And it's interesting because it's, you know, Doom War is a number one issue, and they kind of dive right into it. And I had a lot of the context of what was going on because I had just read those Black Panther issues. I thought that they could have done a lot better job on bringing you up to speed on some of it in the context of the story about what was going on than they did. And for someone who didn't read the Black Panther issues, I'm curious about that. And the choice is, you know, it's like that very first page, it says Doom War Part 1, and it's a whole page, and it's got these really big, you know, credits for everybody. You know, they couldn't have done like what they do on most other Marvel books and put a few paragraphs of, you know, what has gone before and kind of set the thing up on what had been going on in Black Panther. It just seemed kind of funny to me.
I thought they did an okay job kind of recapping the highlights and stuff. The choice of using the BBC reporter to do that, typical writing crutch or whatever. I was more okay with that when, you know, the guard started, it's like, hey, shut that camera off kind of a thing. And it's like, okay, I guess that part's over with. For a first issue of a quasi-event sort of a thing, and it's not really an event, but just a named storyline in its own miniseries or whatever. I felt they got the story moving, had a number of major plot points, and, you know, more than enough for me to be happy with this issue.
No, I didn't say it was terrible. I just said they could have done better.
No, and I'm not trying to imply that you said that. You know, what I am saying is that the extra pages helped out, but the key is that all the pages were well used. They told enough story in here and gave me enough context just within these pages as to what's going on. What I did find really kind of funny is you've got this political party having taken over Wakandia, and Dr. Doom is using it essentially as a cover for a bank heist. I mean, you could almost read through all of his scenes using Hans's voice from Die Hard for Doom, and it would pretty much fit the dialogue, which I thought was kind of funny. I thought the use of the X-Men was pretty good, and I mean, Dr. Doom is getting a little overused lately. Again, he's been fighting Black Panther in his title, Brother Voodoo in his title, causing trouble in the future over an X-Factor. But, you know, hey, the villains have taken over, so I guess we should expect overexposure for most of them. Overall, I thought this was good. Could they and should they have done a better recap at the beginning? Yeah, certainly. But I took that opening page of credits as two things. One, them trying to assert this is a first issue, you should be able to come in cold, whether you can or not. I'll leave that to somebody who hasn't read all the preceding stuff to determine. But two, it almost reeked of more of a movie-style credits, and as if this had scrolled up and then they start the movie. And I guess I kind of give that a bit of a pretentiousness aspect to it, I guess. Because, again, it feels like they're trying to be more cinematic than comic book, and it's a comic book.
Well, you know, with the BBC reporter, I mean, pretty wordy character, and I think that, you know, they could have just tweaked it around a little bit for her to be giving a recap on, you know, what's been going on lately in Wakanda with, you know, the Black Panther and you know, Shuri and, you know, all these other kind of things that are relatively public knowledge, and then dove into the Aurora on trial thing. You know, it just, you know, could have been two or three panels and just going on with it. And I am interested in what Doom wants to do with the vibranium. It looks like he wants to, like, enhance all these Doom bots with it and go crazy. I do think that, you know, they left us off on a really good point. That Wakandan counselor who kind of gets it at the end, you know, he had that coming mm-hmm. for a long time. He was getting on my nerves throughout all those issues of Black Panther. That was a good issue. I actually liked it I thought it did a better job of setting up and justifying its existence than the first issue of Siege. War. Siege did.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that's to me where the strength of this issue was, is do we need to have Doom War? I'm going to say probably not, but I mean, how many comics do we really need? But, you know, it's not a story that I felt there was a mandate for, given what else is going on in the Marvel Universe. Yet within this issue, they set it up, they pretty much justify it, and they move a good plot point or two beyond that. I mean, they could have ended the first issue with, hey, Wakandian's been taken over. Next issue, hey, you know, Doom's using it as a cover of a bank heist. Next issue, you know, kind of a thing. But they, again, they packed enough in here that I thought it was solid.
I do recommend, though, that anyone who, I mean, if you pick up this issue and you like it, you might want to poke around for those last few issues of Black Panther that came out, because there's some fairly decent backstory to what's going on here at the end of the Black Panther run, which I don't know if it's canceled or if it's on hiatus. I'm guessing that when they bring it back, they'll take the opportunity to start it with a new number one.
Yeah, possibly even a new Black Panther. Who knows?
Yeah, but, you know, those issues should be available.
Yeah, and I agree. They're worth checking out. For me, I gave this 4 because it definitely exceeded my expectations. It felt it had more story in it, you know, than frankly a lot of comics these days.
It had a decent amount. It was 34 pages long, so it's actually I'm happy that Marvel is kind of moving back to giving a little more value for the $3.99 book, because their recent trend had been, you know, kind of given the finger to their fans, essentially, by taking any kind of pseudo-event miniseries title and jacking the price to $3.99 while keeping the story content at 22 pages. So I was pleasantly surprised in seeing a 34-page story for $3.99. I would have expected that would have been the perfect opportunity with that number of pages for them to make it $4.99 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So, applause to them on keeping it, you know, a good value. And, you know, with the John Romita, the Eaton art, rather. It was actually very nice art. It was actually, I say John Romita almost because it was sort of evocative of John Romita Jr. It had a little bit of that flavor in it.
Yeah.
But not exactly.
Well, what I liked is between the art and the story, I felt I got more out of those 34 pages than I kind of did in the 40-page main story of Supergirl.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes down to how many real major plot points are there. And there were quite a few in Supergirl. So I don't know what it was about that story that left me a little colder than the Doom War one, when I expected it to kind of be the opposite. So what rating did you give Doom Morgan?
4.
Move on to our other book.
The Incredibles, number 5 from Boom Studios. Another one, I had not read an issue of this run of Incredibles yet, so I read 1 through 5. Interesting, 1 through 3 were kind of a story, and then 5 is part 2 of a story that started in number 4.
Yeah, and I thought they made a couple of missteps here. I mean, I love the Incredibles movie, I like the characters, so I'm enjoying the series, but this is one where they start in the middle of the story. No recap. You kind of sort of get some clues throughout the story as to where things had left off. But compared to the other two issues we've talked about already, both of which were oversized, it felt like not much happened here. This is a standard 22-page story. It's the middle part of a story. And it felt like an act of a television show between the commercial breaks and not a complete episode. Whereas I got that kind of a feeling out of pretty much both the other two comics we talked about. And I don't want to come across harsh on this, because I do think it's a good title, but again, the leaping in the middle of the story, no recap and stuff like that, I enjoyed this, but they could have done a better job.
I liked it more contextually, having just read issue 4, you know, 30 seconds before I read this one, because I think if a kid got handed just this issue, it wouldn't have been that satisfying to him.
Yeah.
Because, again, it was a little hard to figure out. I mean, ultimately, you can piece it together near the end of the issue, what's going on, if you were reading this out of context. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you don't even get really any of the heroes in costume. I mean, you got Mr. and Mrs. Incredible on that one page, you know, really, and you got Violet coming in at the end. But, I mean, you really don't even have the title characters kind of doing anything in costume. And it works as part of the story arc, but as a standalone issue, it was a little lacking. And I'm looking again at if I was to take this comic, which is aimed at kids, and just out of context of anything else, handed just this issue to a kid, I think it wouldn't have been that satisfying a read for a kid who's a fan of The Incredibles.
Well, I would say not only that, because I think you're spot on there, but also from my own perspective as a not kid, somebody who has read the previous issues but also reads a ton of comics every week and therefore don't necessarily, you know, have instant recall on every previous issue of everything I'm trying to currently read, I thought they could have done better in terms of just general accessibility, and because it lacked that kind of context, because they didn't try to have it that accessible, it cut down my enjoyment of it. And it's funny, because I don't want to come down on the Boom Kids line, because, you know, the other thing I read this morning, because I wanted to read it after The Incredibles, and after thinking, wow, it was good, but it was light, it was, you know, whatever. I read the Uncle Scrooge comic that came out this week, 388. That's the storytelling style they should be using for this book. Because in Uncle Scrooge, which is the first part of a story, and it was a 24-page story versus 22 here, it's more of an old-school storytelling style, kind of like a comic from the 1980s, whereas The Incredibles here is paced kind of like a normal comic from today, where it's going to take a couple issues to tell the story, and it's a more leisurely style, you get the character moments, that kind of a thing. Whereas with Uncle Scrooge, man, they just hit the ground running, they establish what the story's going to be, they get some good lines in, they get some character moments in, they get a plot point or two, okay, you get to the next resolution of that, you get another plot point, you get going, you'll end on a good kind of a cliffhanger-ish sort of a thing or whatever with a sense of jeopardy, and enough for you to feel like you've gotten a lot of story told in an expedited style, certainly, but enough plot points in that you're invested in the story. Whereas here, you know, I didn't feel there was really that many plot points that happened. And it would be interesting if they were to do some of their other kids' books in that other kind of a storytelling style. You know, I think Boom is doing a great job with an all-ages line. I would just like them see them doing an even better job, and again, something to where you could hand any issue of The Incredibles to a kid, even if it's the middle of a story, and then feel they got a full story out of the issue.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know why they don't do this, but, you know, just having a recap on the inside of the front cover would have gone a long way towards, you know, kind of bringing you up to speed on what's going on. It's just maybe they think, well, a kid's not going to want to read a bunch of text, but, you know, I think a kid would. Or, you know, if it's a little kid, their parent would read it to them. That wouldn't completely fix this issue, but it would do something. I mean, it could, like, point out that Dash had seen, you know, some funny things with his teachers, you know, that his parents were acting weird. And
yeah, and give you the context to understand where the story's picking up from.
Exactly.
And that gets it over that hurdle.
You know, you still have your kind of lack of general in-costume action, which I think in a book about The Incredibles targeted at kids, you should go out of your way to include in each issue.
It just seems like they're doing a slower, more character-based, you know, character moment-based sort of a story, whereas for a kid's title, I've got to think that a more keep-it-moving, keep-action-happening, a faster-paced kind of storytelling, again, like is happening over in Uncle Scrooge by Boom Kids, might work better. So, I mean, I'm enjoying this. I thought this was good. I gave it a 3. But this is something that I think if they were to, again, employ the storytelling style like the Uncle Scrooge stuff, they could have a huge hit on their hands.
I gave it a 3 also for pretty much the same reasons. So, good solid one. And I think to a large extent, you can assume that if somebody's buying The Incredibles, they're going to be buying every issue of The Incredibles. You know, in that context, it maybe isn't that big of a tragedy or anything like that, but especially since they've got the Boom Kids line in at, like, Disney stores and, you know, theme parks and things like that, they maybe should be assuming that every issue of The Incredibles is the first one someone's going to pick up and hand to a kid and really try to structure each issue to read like that.
Yeah, I certainly think they should.
So other than that, since I ended up having to read about 20-some-odd comics to be, you know, the first for the three issues that we reviewed here this week, I didn't read that many other comics this week, although I did read the Simpsons issue that came out, which Sergio Aragonés did. I liked that a little bit less than I was thinking I was going to.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed a little off for a Simpsons story. I mean, it had great, you know, Sergio art and everything, but it just seemed a little, something was kind of tickling me the wrong way about it. And then I read the Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps Blackest Night issues.
Yeah, I read the Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps stuff. That's, again, they're doing great stuff with the Blackest Night. I just really, really loving that. I'm still having computer problems, so while I was waiting for virus scans to run and other crap to go on, versus actually doing things on my computer, I had a bit more time to read than normal. So I've read everything that came out in my shipment this week. And there was some good stuff. The stuff they're doing over with the Fall of the Hulks is kind of interesting, but still hasn't really clicked with me entirely. But we're getting some new gods action, it looks like, over in Justice League, which I was pleasantly surprised with. I hadn't realized that was coming down. There's some good stuff. I mean, nothing that really just jumps out saying, oh, wow, people have definitely gotta check this out above all others. Again, for me, the highlight every week is I'll start with pretty much the Blackest Night comics, because they're just doing a great job on that. And to me, that goes back to what we were talking about last week of, you know, Geoff Johns becoming the chief creative officer over at DC. It's like, he knows how to tell stories. He knows how to get other people on other titles to play into those things or to bring out the best of out of them and stuff. So I really support that decision that DC made to put him in that role.
So on sort of comic-related things that hit the internet this week, were, as I think we theorized, that Green Lantern ring that they were advertising with Brightest Day number one is, in fact, now going to be, as we everyone pretty much saw coming, I think, going to be a white ring. And they reveal the White Lantern in Blackest Night number 7, which you and I don't have yet, but came out past Wednesday as this is going up. I don't think that's any great, you know, people on the internet are saying, oh, you know, they should have not revealed the white ring thing, because apparently that story hit before Blackest Night number 7 came out. And it's like, well, you know, I think we all knew that that was coming. I don't think anyone could not know that a White Lantern was coming.
Well, I think we kind of knew that the minute we saw the after Blackest Night comes Brightest Day and the white logo.
Yeah.
But, you know, they could have, the way I would recommend doing the marketing is you want the people reading the comics to feel like they saw it there first. And if the comic comes out on Wednesday, should you release the press releases Wednesday? No, I would actually wait a good couple of days. People are not necessarily going to get their books on that Wednesday. They're certainly not going to read all their books on that Wednesday. And if you're jumping the gun by people finding about it in a news article or, again, a blog posting or whatever versus in the story, that just seems counterproductive in the long run. Is this a big surprise? No, not really.
Some of the logic there might be, you know, that a lot of the people who are prowling around on the news sites on the internet are, in fact, running to the comic shop. Not all of us, right? But I think a large percentage of them are, in fact, running to the comic shop on Wednesday and getting their comics, you know, first thing. So, you know, I have mixed emotions about it. I mean, it's not like, it doesn't bother me because I pretty much stay away from Newsarama except for, you know, when somebody points me to a specific article there and, you know, usually tells me if there's spoilers in it or, you know, for the new item solicits, I usually, you know, go out to those sites and look for the new item solicits to put up on our forum. But, you know, it doesn't bother me that much because I think people who are chronically prowling those comics news sites are the same general sort of people who, you know, rush to the comic shop to get the books like right when they come out.
But that's actually kind of why it does bother me, because I'd rather that those people be focusing on what's coming out now, not what's the next best thing. Because I think it takes the shelf life of some stuff and just kills it in terms of the interest in that. Because instead of people talking about what happened in, you know, Doom War, Supergirl, whatever, we're already talking about, well, here's this ring that's going to come out in 3 months or 4 months or 5 months or whatever. And that the comic marketing community need, and I'm not saying this is going to be easy, but they need to find a way to get us interested in things when they need to be solicited, certainly, but not so focused on what's coming that we're ignoring what's now. Because if they did a better job on keeping us interested in what's on the rack right now, maybe they'd sell better, and, you know, that would help promote things that are coming down the pike. I'm just, it's crazy theory, I know. The thing that got me with the white ring is, yes, no big surprise that the promo one's going to be a white one. I appreciate they're including a light-up one in the Spectrum set they already announced. No big surprise there, but nice to do. But man, that Justice League Trophy Room collection that was 200 and some odd 50 bucks or whatever, that's looking like a worse and worse deal.
Well, I didn't buy that, but, you know, I think that it didn't have the black ring either.
Actually, I thought it did. I thought it had the...
No, I don't think it did.
I thought it had the 7 around and the black on top.
No, it actually had 6 around and the green one in the middle.
Oh, well, I was wrong then, okay.
And then the 6 around, and the reason I didn't buy it was that, you know, the ones that were around were not even in Spectrum order.
Yeah.
It was just like, it seemed like in some kind of random order, and it had the green one in the middle, which I can see putting the green one in the middle because, you know, Green Lantern is, you know, the most popular, but and it seems like the ones on the round, the edges could have at least been in, you know, the Spectrum order. But
hey, but be thankful, because otherwise you would have ordered that. And as all these other announcements come down, you'd be getting a little more and more annoyed or would have had to cancel it or whatever. You know, it's...
That is true. But, you know, I'll tell you what, if I see that at some con, you know, some shop that, you know, ordered that thinking someone was going to buy it, if someone's dumping it for 40 or 50 bucks at a con sometime, I'll probably pick it up at that price point.
Well, at that price point, yeah. But that kind of sucks for the shop.
Yeah, for 200 bucks or whatever it was, I was like, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't think so. You know, then we had a controversy that hit this week about Nick Simmons' art on Incarnate, which is kind of too bad, but pretty darn compelling evidence. They're showing panels from Incarnate overlaid with panels from Bleach, and there appear to be like line-by-line, you know, similarities in panel layout and figure composition. And Radical, I think, was pretty quick to suspend publication and sale of that pending finding out, you know, if, you know, what actually went on there. So I would applaud Radical on that, because I don't think anyone had any idea, you know, because I read Incarnate and I liked the story. I don't read Bleach and I don't read some of these other mangas. So whether or not there was, you know, these really strong similarities that, you know, once they're pointed out, it's like, oh, wow, that is a pretty strong similarity. It looks like there definitely is not coincidence going on here from the amount of similarity that there is. You have to be reading both, and you have to be very observant to notice that. You know, it's interesting that that came to light.
I respect Radical for the stand they took on it. While
yeah.
It may seem like they threw their creator under the bus or whatever, what kind of a stronger stance can you take on creator rights other than standing up for it, even when it puts your company, one of your titles, and one of your creators in potentially the wrong side of that equation?
Well, I think they looked at the evidence that had been posted out there, and when you look at that, we've got a link on the forum, but I mean, when you look at that stuff, it's like, wow. It's like not a whole lot of conclusion you can draw there other than, I mean, this looks like literally when the one website that like actually overlays the panels, I mean, it's like identical.
But how many times have we seen posts like that before about a Marvel comic, a DC comic, an Image, or Dark Horse, or, you know, some other publisher? And the publisher stays quiet.
Yep.
And the creator never really says much or defends it or whatever. You know, this is the first time I recall, not that I really follow this stuff, but that the publisher said, hey, yeah, this isn't right. We're going to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, to me, that's a major stand for creator rights in doing it in favor of the original creator, not the one they're currently publishing.
Right.
A brave move for them to take. Unfortunate they had to, but again, really respect the fact they did. Hopefully this will get resolved to everyone's satisfaction. But yeah, looking at a couple of those things, there were one or two that, okay, maybe an homage, but a few others, it's like, no.
And when you have, like, the quantity that there are, it's not like, you know, like where it's like a single image or something, but there's like a definite pattern, you know, just, oh well.
Yeah.
You know, I was entertained by the story, but, you know, it is what it is there.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Well, I think that's all I had for this week.
Okay, cool. I guess it'll do it then.
Join us next week when we discuss Flash Rebirth number 6 from DC, Thunderbolts number 141 from Marvel, and Broken Trinity Pandora's Box number 1 from Top Cow.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.